welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the case against common good constitutionalism. And Richard, we dedicate our conversation this week to this topic because of a piece that garnered a lot of attention last week, appeared at The Atlantic, from Adrian Vermeule, Harvard Law professor, who was arguing that conservatives should dispose of originalism in favor of this project that he calls common good constitutionalism. And I'd encourage people to read the entire piece if they want to understand what he's getting at here. It's kind of hard to summarize, but in short, he thinks that we have a system that is too dependent on what he calls libertarian conceptions of property rights and economic rights, that it's too permissive on social issues like abortion, free speech, what he calls sexual liberties, and that it doesn't go far enough in its ability to hold corporations to account and its ability to compulse people and to provide what you have to kind of read interstitially, but what certainly seems like a lot more economic redistribution than what we have under the current system. And so he doesn't categorize a lot of what he's describing. It is of a piece with aspects of what used to be called paleoconservatism, aspects of Catholic integralism, and aspects of this new brand of conservatism that is suspicious of classical liberalism. So there's a ton for us to do here. Let's start with the adjective here, the common good. The piece that you wrote in response to this for Defining Ideas contains a very important riff on something called methodological individualism, which may sound musty, but this is actually a very interesting point about how we analyze collective decision making. So have at it, Richard.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wrote a book some years ago called Principles for Free Society, Reconciling Individual Liberty with the Common Good. So I don't want it to be thought that when you start to talk about common good, that immediately you necessarily put yourself into the camp of communist, socialist, or some other kind of intellectual undesirable. The question is, which way do you start to think about it? And there have been two traditions that have been around for a very long time. One of them is a tradition which is associated originally with people like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, where he started to talk about the general will. And what happened is you find out that this particular general will is not the will of any individual or the will of all individuals summed up together in one way or another. So it's kind of a free-floating operation. And when Adrian starts to talk about the common good constitutionalism, he has exactly that kind of a situation. And so what happens is if you look at a society and you start to see that there are people who are in conflict with one another, the question then comes out, how do you figure out what is or is not the common good? One particular clause of the Constitution that this thing seems to resonate with is a clause which talks about the ability of Congress to tax and spend for the general welfare of the United States, where at least it's not too much of a riff to say that general welfare and common good are cut to some extent from the same cloth. Now, I come from the methodological individualism school of thinking, and it certainly says that you have to worry about the way in which you treat aggregates. We talk about the government, we talk about a corporation, we talk about a school, we talk about a committee, and so forth. And it turns out that we cannot organize our social or collective lives unless we talk about these cooperative entities. But when you're trying to address the soundness of what they do or how they work, it's important to understand how they're organized. And so if you take something like a corporation, typically if it's a public corporation, they have a single class of stock. All the shares are essentially fungible with one another, so that there's no way that you can, if you treat all shares equally, favor one guy over the other. And this then allows you to create a market whereby you can alienate the shares, because whoever buys one share doesn't care whether it comes from A or B. And what we do is we have, therefore, as a first approximation, a very nice alignment among shareholders. So therefore, if in fact you have these intermediate structures, they're designed to preclude redistribution so that statements about the whole will generally translate to statements about the welfare of all individuals. If, however, you took this corporation and what you did is you now gave it the power to decide that it's going to take money from all the shareholders whose letters, last names begin with the letter A or B and give it to those with X or Y, at that point it's a straight transfer system one way or another, and all the benefits of this kind of system of share identification are lost. They're now just transfers from A to B. And you ask yourself, who's going to invest in a corporation if the board of directors could pick you out at random as somebody for whom you could tax specially or somebody from whom you could receive benefits? Everything would fall apart. So essentially what happens is when we put collective entities together, we're designed to protect against that kind of opportunism. Then take it back to what we say about the general welfare clause. Adrian doesn't read the full thing in context, which you have to do, and it's tax and power to pay the debt. And what they mean by that is the public debt, the debt of everybody. They don't mean to pay the debt of John or Smith, to provide for the common defense. That's the defense of everybody in the United States, and to provide for the general welfare of the United States, which is to be understood as meaning putting into place those kinds of measures, like those which are done by a well-organized corporation, which advance uniformly the rights of all individuals. So methodological individualism is essentially the thing that prevents these collective endeavors from blowing up, because nobody will contribute to a collective venture if the people who are in charge of it have the power to wipe you out or to benefit you. And so the general welfare has to be tightly tethered, as it was for a very, very long time, in most cases, to say you can't benefit A at the expense of B. And in Adrian's view, making A, B, C, D, and E better off uniformly is no different from a common good constitution, which says that you could take from A and could give to B. And those things should be treated as polar opposites. And under this particular common good constitutionalism, often they're treated as though they're identical.
This dovetails nicely into the next thing that I was going to ask you. One of Vermeule's arguments early in this piece is that conflating originalism with classical liberalism, or even positing a significant overlap between them, is a sleight of hand, that really the founders' vision was not classically liberal in nature, that individual liberty was not all that high in their hierarchy of values. I'm speaking with the author of a book entitled The Classical Liberal Constitution. How do you parry with his argument?
Well, I think that if you look at the Constitution, the first thing you have to understand is it's motivated by two elements. One of them, there is the clear necessity to figure out how you get a deal together amongst states that are in a very difficult situation. And the obvious deal killer that existed at that particular time was slavery. You could have probably gotten a majority of the delegates to say we want to ban slavery as immoral, but but also discover at the same time is that you would lose key states like Virginia and South Carolina and so forth, so you'd have no union at all. So what you did is you put into place an elaborate set of compromises on those issues, which were designed to preserve slavery against the general takeaways from the federal government, with certain limitations on it. So it's a compromise in the sense you could not import slaves into the United States under any circumstances after 1808, but on the other hand, you couldn't stop the internal slave trade within the United States, nor could you pass any kind of legislation which says that if you are trying to sell goods from a state, slave state, some other state of the federal government could ban you from shipping those goods into interstate commerce, thus cutting you off from your natural or your international market. So that is certainly a very large part of what's going on. But then you start looking at the rest of the Constitution, and it's pretty clear that they have very much the principles of classical liberalism in mind, if you take into account both the original Constitution and, of course, the key Bill of Rights. So in the structural situation, one of the things that you see in the classical liberal tradition is writings through Locke and Montesquieu, later endorsed by Madison, talking about the importance of separation of powers on the grounds that we never want to give any one person sufficient power so that they can control the way in which everything operates. And it turns out there is no unique solution to the problem of division of powers under separation of powers and checks and balances. But you can see that these guys thought extremely hard about it in order to make sure that they kind of got the best solution to the problem. It was imperfect. They didn't imagine administrative agencies like we have today. And they were keying it to a government which had 13 states and about 3.5 million people. And, you know, we have 100 times the population today and a lot more states and a lot more complexity. So the system tends to creak and groan. One of the reasons why you're an originalist is you sort of like the fact that the basic structure is one that comports with classical liberalism. One of the reasons you're uneasy about it is the change in scale. It means that you have to make adaptations, including, for example, the creation of administrative agencies to deal with the fact that the system of delegated authority that works in a small organization doesn't work in a large one. So you certainly understand that on the original side. The second thing is, you start looking at the protection of various rights, freedom of religion, impairment of contract, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation, procedural due process, essentially, each and every one of these things were learned from the mishaps that took place either in ancient Rome or in England. And what they did is they put self-conscious barriers against the way in which those particular abuses would take place. And so you see Salmon Chase writing very early on, he says, it's just outrageous to think you could run a particular government where you could put somebody in jail for no reason at all, or make him to be tried before a biased official of one kind or another. So all the natural law principles are very much indeed a part of the basic constitution. And so what I wrote in the classical liberal constitution, I said, I'm not going to try and defend the pro-slavery provisions of the constitution. I don't think that's my job. But if you look at the rest of it and put it in the intellectual tradition of Smith and Madison and Hume and Locke and Montesquieu, it fits very, very well. Now, does originalism always work? The answer is no. First of all, you have to know how to do it, and it's not just simply textualism. And secondly, there's something that I wrote about in the classical liberal constitution on the updating function called the prescriptive constitution. There were many great structural failures in the original constitution. They were not failures of classical liberalism. They were failures of institutional design. So, for example, it's pretty clear under the original Constitution that the final word about the constitutionality of the provisions of the federal Constitution would be left to state judges in different states. Now, that's an invitation to suicide. And in a case called Martins against Hunter's lessee, Justice Story essentially bit his teeth, misread everything, because he knew if he allowed the states of Virginia and the state of Massachusetts to have inconsistent interpretation of a federal statute, the union was over. And so we changed it. And in Marbury v. Madison, we introduced judicial supremacy. So one of the problems with originalism is it has to be updated to correct mistakes, and then it has to be updated again when you correct mistakes by making bigger mistakes like Plessy and Ferguson and the whole situation with racism. And so it's a much more complicated principle. But this doesn't mean that originalism is just outdated. What it means is it's one of the key principles, a necessary component of any sound system of constitutional interpretation. But it's one that has to be supplemented by a variety of techniques, some of which are well established in Roman and early English law, and others of which are designed to sort of update an institution, just the way the law of adverse possession and prescription in the law of land manages to update title so as to make grants that were originally illegal legal because of their acceptance in the passage of long periods of time. So it's a really complicated pastiche, but none of this gives any legitimacy to the kind of fuzzy collective good that Adrian wants to put into place, where, of course, all the virtuous people like him are going to be at the top, and everybody else is going to have to sort of march to these rather alien drummers.
All right. I want to work through, actually, some of those affirmative arguments here on the back end of the show, because some of these are upmarket versions of critiques of libertarianism or classical liberalism that you hear a lot. So let's start with this one. I'll read you the quote. Unlike legal liberalism, and here he means classical liberalism by that, unlike legal liberalism, common good constitutionalism does not suffer from a horror of political domination and hierarchy because it sees that law is parental, a wise teacher, and an inculcator of good habits. Just authority and rulers can be exercised for the good of subjects, if necessary, even against the subjects' own perceptions of what is best for them, perceptions that may change over time anyway, as the law teaches, habituates, and reforms them. Subjects will come to thank the ruler. And it goes on from there. So this is something you hear a lot. How can you build a system around individual autonomy when most people aren't savvy enough to know what's good for them? Your response.
Well, first of all, I think it's a hugely condescending thing to say about most people. They don't know the way in which they work. There are two ways in which you acquire knowledge. And one of them, if you're an academic like me or Adrian, is you tend to sit back and you think hard about arrangements and how they work. And you come up with grand theories. Most people don't do that. What they do is they situate themselves in the world and they try things first this way and then that way. And they slowly develop an accumulated set of practices that seem to work pretty well for them. These then coalesce across large numbers of individuals so that when you get the common practice decentralized in its creation, it turns out to do very, very well by the people involved. And so that's the kind of thing that is sometimes associated with customary law in England and with the sort of Hayekian incrementalism when you start talking about political theory. I think Adrian systematically underestimates the extent to which these traditions tend to work and work out pretty well. And then there's always the question about, you know, who's going to be the leader? why should we put the control in the hands of somebody whose own beliefs are antithetical to large numbers of people? We've lived with people who have religious fervor, and they tend to favor their own, and they tend to discriminate against others. One of the things that the Founding Fathers did when they didn't want to have federally established churches is they certainly didn't want to have this kind of situation at the federal level, although they were perfectly prepared, given the powerful autonomy interests of the state at the time, to allow state-established religions to work, to be governed by internal rules. And so you then have to ask the question, these subjects are going to be happy about what their rulers do. Well, sometimes their rulers do really terrible things. If you want an illustration of just how dangerous rulers can be in times where they're given sort of arbitrary and complete power, I suggest anybody look at the way in which the governors have behaved with respect to the coronavirus, putting one decree after another. They don't consult with the legislatures. They don't reveal the basis of their information. They seem to have arbitrary power over the lives of millions of individuals. And for the most part, they have no idea what they're talking about. That's going to be an absolutely endemic kind of problem. So what you want to do in the central government is to follow the framers' view that it's enumerated powers. You figure out those kinds of things for which individual private actions cannot do. There's no way you can have a private army for everybody to defend you against somebody else. You're going to have a neutral system of courts. You're going to have a system of public taxation in order to support these kinds of things. You're going to have to put together institutions that allow you to put together lists so you can know whom to tax on this system and whom you could give pensions to under that system and so forth. And so what they did is they had a much cleverer view of the situation. They said, where do we need government? What kinds of powers do we have? That's what we're going to do. Where do we not need government? And what are we going to tell to ignore it? So you don't need a government to tell people how to pray. You don't need a government to tell you what kind of profits you make into a market. But you do need a government to deal, at least arguably, with the problems that are associated with the capture of public institutions and turning them to private goods, or the creations of various kinds of cartels and monopoly. And in fact, the great tragedy of the New Deal is that having lost sight of what it was that you're supposed to do, you had a lot of guys talking about the common good. And they created one cartel after another under the early years of the New Deal. And most of these have lasted for very long times. The classical liberal has one thing he's really worried about, which is monopoly. And it turns out the common good guy, he has a very different view of the world. It's fine to have a monopoly so long as I get to run it. But there's nobody who's smart enough to run one of these things. And so what you want to do in the center is not only to give power to do the things that have to be done, you want to make sure that there are no powers to do things that ought not to be done. No state shall make any law impairing the obligation of contract and so forth. The negative liberty parts of our Constitution are extremely important. And in terms of Adrian's world, they all disappear. I mean, Adrian, before this even, was always a kind of a strong Thayerian, somebody who believed that only under the strongest possible grounds do you declare any statute unconstitutional. And I could recall several conversations with him where there was no statute in the history of the United States that he thought was unconstitutional, which is, I think, even a more extreme position than the ones that I'm prepared to take on a large number of issues.
So the final passage that I'll ask you to react to, not unrelated to that, again, quoting him, thinking that the common good and its corollary principles have to be grounded in specific texts is a mistake. They can be grounded in the general structure of the constitutional order and in the nature and purposes of government. The Supreme Court, like Congress and the presidency, has often drawn upon broad structural and natural law principles to determine the just authority of the state. Police power, which despite its misleading name refers to the general power of state governments to protect health, safety, order, and public morality, is nowhere mentioned in the written Constitution. America's real efficient Constitution is largely unwritten or uncodified, as is true of constitutions everywhere, close quote. Now, our listeners will recognize some of those arguments, not in tone that different from things that you've said here from time to time, but you and Vermeule are not getting to the same place with them. So how would you explain the analytical differences there that lead you and him to very different limiting principles where this is concerned?
First of all, when I started to talk about the principles of interpretation, one of the sets of principles you have to talk about are principles of implication. That is, what are the things that are not written in the Constitution that have to be read in it in order for it to be able to make sense one way or another? And some years ago, I gave a lecture at Willamette Law School called Our Implied Constitution, which started to talk about just how pervasive these things were and how you put them in there. But it turns out it's not that you just put in whatever you want under these kinds of characteristics. They're really very precise reasons that make them work. And there are occasional cases where you think twice about the one. So start with the police power. It is nowhere in the Constitution, right? And then the question is, how do you get it? And somebody says, well, we have a principle which protects people. Everybody has the right of freedom of speech. Well, does that mean that I have the right to defame my neighbor because I'm just talking? Does it mean I have a right to hold a gun to his head and say, your money, your life, and say, hey, this is only free speech that I'm engaged in? Do you have a right to commit securities fraud of one kind or another to swindle somebody else out of their good? And everybody who looks at this would start to say, hey, when we talk about the protection of freedom of speech, we're talking about your ability to participate in public debate about the common good. We're not talking about these things, so what makes them different? Well, if you go back and you become a libertarian, the things that you really start to worry about are force and fraud. If you're a classical liberal, you add in the monopoly situation. And so when you start hearing about defamation, those are false words to the detriment of a person, and that falls under the fraud category. The assault category is covered in various kinds of ways. Nuisances are, of course, just terrible things, spewing out pollution. And since the Hyde Park case, fertilizing company case in the 1878, Supreme Court said, of course you could shut down somebody who's about to breathe to you. But if you're taking Adrian's, you can do whatever you want with health. So that means you could tell an employer, in the name of health, you have to give free medical care to all your workers. And in the name of safety, what you have to do, in effect, is to supply every one of your workers with a car, which has got all sorts of advantage gimmicks. They're all safety devices. But that's not what the Constitution was about. It was about exactly the opposite. What we're allowed to do under a classical liberal government is to protect you against the kinds of things which, if you had the force and the wherewithal to do it, you could protect yourself. And so you could bring a private action for nuisance, a private action to deal with defamation, private action to deal with fraud or assault and so forth. And it turns out when the transactions break down, it's under those circumstances that you could turn to the government as your agent to make sure that it's going to stop these kinds of people. It's this not common good constitutional in his sense. It's essentially trying to make up for the transactional weaknesses of private rights of action when you need some sort of government to there. And so let me just end with one case to tell you just how dangerous this thing could be if you want to unmoor it. There's a famous set of common law rules which say that any individual is entitled to build up on his land as high as he or she wants to do, because it is not a nuisance for you to build, even though it blocks somebody else's view, blocks somebody else's light, blocks somebody else's air. And so you say, well, why do you have that principle? Well, suppose it turns out you say it is a common law nuisance to do those things. Then somebody wants to build his house at the first time. Say, you can't build that house because if you build your house, I won't be able to build my house because you're declared a common law nuisance. So you then get to the situation, oh, nobody can build on anything because always this fear is going to be there. So nobody believes that principle. You go exactly to the opposite extreme. And then if you want protection, you could get it through covenants or through average reciprocity of advantage and the kinds of restrictions that you're going to put into place. Now, what happens is, in one of the famous cases involving the Fontainebleau Hotel and the Eden Rock, one of them built their thing up so as to cast a shadow across the swimming pool on the other side. And the judge rightly said, not a common law nuisance. They want to work it out. They could work it out by agreement. But the judge also said, if you don't like this, you could always get a zoning law to change it. That's not what zoning is about. Because at that particular point, each of these guys are going to go in, and they're going to try and ask for very specialized zoning rules, which will protect their light, their air, and their view, but wipe out everybody else's. So the key element in zoning is that the only way under a theory of limited government that you can make this work is to limit the objects of a zoning system to those which are legitimately achieved by a private system of nuisance actions and a private set of restrictive covenants that reciprocally are put into place. These are completely different conceptions of how the world works. And in the one, if you spend any time watching the way local governments start to work when they designate things, it is simply a disgrace in many cases because all the stuff that they're doing in many, many situations is simply a fig leaf disguise. I don't want this competitor coming into my town. You keep him out. And if you could keep him out, I'll be better off and I'll pay you a political corruption and all the other citizens will be done. So this is not what you want. Adrian's system is the most dangerous system in the world, and regrettably, it's too much like we have today. The reason I wrote all this book about the classical liberal constitution is if you start with the first of the zoning cases, Euclid against Ambler, it is an absolute disgrace. Every conceivable objective of zoning was frustrated by this particular zoning, and Justice Sutherland, on a very bad day, upheld it. What we have to do is to make sure that the classical liberal principles that govern private relationships between individuals also govern the relationships between individuals and the state. And what Adrian wants to do is to completely sever the two, at which point his benevolent rulers will be able to heap mayhem upon the rest of the world.
All right. You've been listening to The Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can also follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.